tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Sarah Williams reporting. The leaders of Taiwan and China engaged in a historic handshake Saturday before beginning a summit in Singapore. It's the first face-to-face meeting between the two sides since 1949. Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou and Chinese leader Xi Jinping smiled and waved to a throng of journalists, then began their meeting. Xi spoke at the opening of the meeting. He said, "No force can pull us apart. We are one family." Ma also spoke. He said, "Even though this is the first meeting, we feel like old friends." He said he's determined to promote peace across the Taiwan Strait, adding that both sides should respect each other's values and way of life. Authorities in China are predicting the meeting will be a major historic milestone in the development of cross-strait relations. Meanwhile, in Taiwan, angry protesters tried to storm parliament in Taipei as Mao left for the meeting. Police stopped them, and there were no reports of arrests. A top U.S. military official in the Middle East says the pace of U.S. airstrikes targeting Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq is likely to increase in the coming weeks after a lull in September and October. Air Force Lieutenant General Charles Brown said Saturday the slowdown in coalition bombing raids was due to poor weather and a lack of movement by Islamic State forces on the ground. Look at our website at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Egyptian Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry is accusing the United States, Britain, and other foreign nations of withholding shared intelligence with Egypt about the crash of a Russian passenger jet last week. The Egyptian diplomat told reporters Saturday in Cairo that foreign intelligence indicating the possibility of a bomb blast aboard the plane had not until now been provided to the Egyptian security services. President Barack Obama has rejected the controversial Keystone XL oil pipeline project, a plan to build a nearly 1,900-kilometer oil pipeline to transport Canadian crude to the U.S. Gulf states. VOA correspondent Mary Alice Salinas has more.
The Keystone XL pipeline project had become a centerpiece of the debate over President Obama's environmental agenda and stated commitment to take bold action to curb climate change. With the UN summit on climate change set for Paris in December, Obama rejected construction of the oil pipeline that would have carried crude from Canada to U.S. ports along the Gulf of Mexico.
The State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States. I agree with that decision.
The decision drew sharp and quick reaction from members of the Republican-led Congress who backed construction of the pipeline, saying it would create jobs, reduce oil prices, and U.S. reliance on foreign oil. Mary Alice Salinas, The White House.
A former aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin has been found dead in a hotel room in Washington. The Russian embassy in Washington confirmed Friday that the man was 57-year-old Mikhail Lesin, who served as Russian press minister from 1999 to 2004 and presidential media advisor from 2004 to 2009. The media agency he's credited with founding, Russia Today, reported his cause of death as a heart attack. Russia Today is an English-language news service backed by the Russian government. The World Health Organization has announced that Sierra Leone is officially free of the Ebola virus. The WHO gave the all-clear now that 42 days have passed without any new infections. Ebola has killed 4,000 people over the past several years. Authorities are urging Sierra Leoneans to remain vigilant and continue to respect all the Ebola prevention protocols. The three U.S. Democratic presidential hopefuls took part in a television forum late Friday. MSNBC host Rachel Maddow in Rock Hill, South Carolina, interviewed the candidates separately. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The criteria set by the World Health Organization to declare the end of this current outbreak over. And this is what happened today.
The World Health Organization officially declares Sierra Leone free of the Ebola virus.
The workers in Kenya may not enjoy the labor relations practice which are guaranteed in the Constitution, especially in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Kenyan teachers plan to petition the Supreme Court to challenge a decision that kicks against their pay increase.
We are of the view that AGOA has contributed significantly towards building a mutual beneficial partnership between the U.S. and South Africa.
And the United States warns that South African pork, chicken and beef products may no longer be welcome in the United States. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Organization or WHO announced today that Sierra Leone is officially free of the Ebola virus. Now that 42 days have passed without any new infections. Saturday's announcement was eagerly anticipated in the West African nation that has lost nearly 4,000 people to the virus over the past several years. Eba Kalondo, the WHO spokesperson in Sierra Leone, told me that the people of Sierra Leone deserve commendation for this significant milestone in the country's fight against Ebola.
Sierra Leone has gone 42 days without recording a new positive case of Ebola virus disease. And since the last two negative test results of the last patient with Ebola virus disease, meaning that they had met the criteria set by the World Health Organization for the World Health Organization to declare the end of this current outbreak over. And this is what happened today.
No.
What is important to remember, though, I think, is that now that this current outbreak is over, for WHO and the world, one Ebola case constitutes a new outbreak. So the moving forward, it's really around making sure that all systems stay in place and that vigilance stays as high as it is so that no new case is recorded.
Currently, what is the working relationship between the WHO and the Sierra Leonean government looking forward to ensure there is no more an outbreak?
Under the leadership of the government of Sierra Leone, WHO is supporting the government's priorities, which really is to make sure that all the rapid response capacities that are already in place. This is a country that now knows how to deal with Ebola. Most countries in the world, after almost 18 months of dealing with the most complex and the largest Ebola outbreak in living history, Sierra Leone is one of the few countries that now know what to do should anything happen. But the challenge now is to make sure that all those rapid response capacities remain in place, that community engagement, which was really the cornerstone of the Ebola outbreak response, remains in place. People have to carry on doing what they've always done to be able to meet the significant milestone that Sierra Leone has been able to achieve today. So it's basically to make sure that all the processes, that there is a maintenance of the rapid response capacity to make sure that the surveillance and the vigilance, not only within Sierra Leone, but also around the region, because, you know, this is a neighborhood that still has active transmission in neighboring Guinea. We have four cases in Guinea, and because it's such a close neighbor, these are two sister countries where people, goods, and relationships are not fettered by the notion of borders. So until Guinea gets to zero and then is able to share in a more resilient zero post 42 days, only then can Sierra Leone safely say that we're starting to turn the corner around a new beginning.
Talking about neighboring Guinea, will there be a transfer of knowledge from Sierra Leone to Guinea, aided by the WHO, working to ensure this Ebola disease is kicked out in Guinea as well for good?
Cross-border collaboration already exists. The only change is that there's going to be a much, much more heightened vigilance from both countries, more surveillance. They're sharing more information. The exit screening in Guinea coming into Sierra Leone and vice versa has been stepped up. Security patrols have been stepped up. There's more isolation facilities at both sides of the border. Because I think what both countries do realize is that both fates of both countries lie within the power of both nations. And because they're both part of the Mano River Union, WHO is supporting all countries who have been hit by the Ebola outbreak to ensure that all countries can come to a zero like Sierra Leone has been able to achieve today, but to go further beyond just the 42 days to make sure that Ebola does not come back.
What is WHO's message to the people of Sierra Leone attaining this goal?
It's a significant achievement. A significant achievement. This is the largest, most complex Ebola outbreak in living memory. In living memory, in anywhere on this globe, there are only three countries that have had that experience. Sierra Leone is one that can teach the world of how a nation can pull together with its resources, with its partners, and be able to fight an enemy that nobody can see, nobody can touch, but touches the very heart of what makes us human. WHO has been extremely honored to be able to accompany Sierra Leone and all the other countries that have been affected by the Ebola outbreak to come to this point. But it's not over yet. Vigilance is the only way forward by keeping the standards of heightened alert from all people concerned within the region so that we can move a new corner.
Eba Kalondo is the WHO spokesperson in Sierra Leone. She spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Kenyan teachers are disappointed by an appeals court ruling voiding a lower court order to increase teachers' pay. In a ruling on Friday, the appeals court said the lower court didn't have the power to order pay increases for teachers. But Akello Mizori, Secretary General of Kenya's Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers, or KUPPET, told me the teachers group will petition the Supreme Court to challenge the decision of the appeals court.
This ruling is a disaster for industrial relations in Kenya, because it now indicates that the workers in Kenya may not enjoy the labor relations practice which are guaranteed in the Constitution, especially in Article 1 of the Constitution of Kenya, which guarantees members, workers, to join, form, and participate in activities of a trade union, and also negates the principles of using the Labor and Employment Court to determine disputes of labor in nature. Remember, in this case, the Teacher Service Commission went to court when we were on strike, and they went to that court knowing very well that this court is the court which can determine the issues which were at place. And the court looked at the issues and said this one was a labor dispute and of economic nature. And because of this dispute, the teacher strike was basically basic pay. So when the court finally determined it because there was consent, we were shocked that this appeal court decided to rule that there was no consent. Yet the parties, because I was a party and other parties, including the Attorney General was a party, and they consented to have the judge arbitrate over this man. So Kenyans are really taken aback by this kind of judgment.
The court, the appeals court, specifically said that the lower court judge acted outside the scope of the petition that was before him, and that the court usurped the powers of a constitutional commission. And that is one of the reasons why they made that ruling. So what is your next line of action as teachers' organization?
The skewed nature of this judgment is the reason for which we are going to the Supreme Court. first to determine the constitutional issues which were raised in this judgment. They were skewed because, remember, at the beginning of these proceedings, we did note that the choice of the bench was not the correct one. They forcefully took that opportunity and they said that they were competent enough to hear this matter. This matter of labor dispute, the facts, they got it wrong. And that's the reason for which we are going to the Supreme Court. But we're not ending there. The law which relates to labor dispute must be repealed to give room for the formation of appeal court which exclusively deals with labor matters. Because general judges handling matters of industrial nature have got their own interpretation, and you know the law is an arch. So that's why we are saying, let us move it to a step higher so that the teachers of Kenya can get justice.
How are teachers reacting to this latest development? Because with this ruling, they will not get the 50 to 60% pay increase as awarded to them by the court.
Teachers countrywide in the WhatsApp they are sending me here, they are devastated. They do have lost confidence in the courts. But we are saying that the rule of law must be given a chance. And that is the reason for which we are saying, even we have lost here, this is a democratically elected government which must also respect the institutions which are created to arbitrate. We fail to understand why the appeal court did notice that the judge lacked jurisdiction. The judge that handled this matter is an employment and labor court judge. And is in fact, he's not just a judge, he's the principal judge in that court. So I think without making any reference to any other issues which we suspect, is that we are going to the Supreme Court and we are going to ventilate on a serious note whether the Constitution is inferior to the opinions of judges.
When will you go to the Supreme Court, and what options are there for you to seek redress apart from going to the Supreme Court about this case, because the teachers are not going to get their pay increase as they anticipated?
We are already aware that the teachers are not going to get their pay according to this appeal judgment, I Court of Appeal judgment. But we are going to the Supreme Court to get facts right, because we feel that justice has not been meted at this level.
Akello Mizori is the Secretary General of the Kenyan Union of Post-Primary Education Teachers, KUPPET. He spoke with me from the capital, Nairobi. The United States has notified South Africa that it may suspend a section of the African Growth and Opportunities Act, which means that South African pork, chicken and beef products may no longer be welcome in the United States. The U.S. government has accused South Africa of being unwilling to play by the rules of the trade agreement. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg as the pork wars go from the frying pan into the fire.
After weeks of delays, lapsed deadlines, and rumbling from U.S. meat producers, U.S. President Barack Obama on Thursday announced he was cutting the fat out of a major trade agreement with South Africa, and gave the nation 60 days' notice that he would revoke duty-free status for agricultural goods like pork, chicken, and beef. That move restricts South Africa's rights under the African Growth and Opportunities Act, an accord that allows 39 African nations to export goods to the United States duty-free. The act was renewed in June for another 10 years. South Africa will still be able to send other products to the U.S., but agricultural goods are a big slice of the pie. In 2014, the nation used AGOA to export $176 million worth of agricultural products to the United States. In a strongly worded letter, President Obama said he was taking this step because South Africa continues to impose several long-standing barriers to U.S. trade. The move follows months of lobbying by U.S. trade groups, who say South Africa has been reluctant to allow market access to U.S. products like pork, beef, and chicken, while opening the market for those goods to other countries. But South African trade and industry spokesman Sidwell Madupi said South African officials were not perturbed by the president's strong words. He says the two nations are close to an agreement.
What is important for us as a country, as South Africa? We are optimistic and we are positive that an agreement. We are close to an agreement as South Africa and the U.S. to reach an agreement, because most of the things have been actually met. South Africa, from our side, we have achieved, we have met most of all the things that are of concern.
One concern, he said, remains, and it is highly technical. South African veterinarians are concerned about outbreaks of avian flu among U.S. chickens and would like to broker an agreement that would keep South Africa from having to import affected poultry. South Africa has also long restricted pork imports because of porcine reproductive and respiratory syndrome. Though there is no proof that this disease can be transmitted from imported meat to domestic pigs. But that has not stopped this war over pork from turning into a political pigskin. The nation's official opposition Democratic Alliance is demanding an explanation in Parliament on suspension notice. Jordan Hill Lewis is the party's trade spokesman.
This is frankly nothing short of a disaster. It threatens the livelihoods and jobs of tens of thousands of farm workers on farms across South Africa. So the fact of the matter is it should never have been allowed to come to this. We have known for many months that the US government has been unsatisfied with the pace of the negotiations and that the South African team has missed many deadlines, and that is completely unacceptable. AGOA is very important to the South African economy, and we cannot afford to play a game of high-stakes poker with the livelihoods of so many South African workers.
But Madupe noted that the United States needs South Africa as much as South Africa needs the United States, in effect, escalating the war of words.
We are of the view that AGOA has contributed significantly towards building a mutual, beneficial partnership between the U.S. and South Africa. And we are saying South Africa is also a vital part of the regional integration and development process underway in Africa. And removing South Africa from AGOA will substantially diminish the significance of AGOA for sub-Saharan Africa and the United States.
He says officials from both countries are meeting to try to broker an agreement before the January 1st deadline. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Zimbabwean main opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai of the Movement for Democratic Change said his supporters will no longer fold their hands when attacked by ruling ZANU-PF members. Tsvangirai said this at a rally in President Robert Mugabe's province of Mashonaland West, where ruling party supporters tried but failed to prevent Tsvangirai's meeting. For VOA, Arthur Chigoriwa has details.
Speaking in Alaska Chinoy this afternoon, Tsvangirai castigated what he said was a hired ZANU-PF that was singing near the venue of his rally, said this was a non-ZANU-PF way of intimidating and instilling fear into the people.
ZANU-PF's default mode is instruct violence and intimidation and fear, Mulan. Yes, ZANU-PF harvested fear.
Tsvangirai said it was clear that the police were taking sides with ZANU-PF, yet the ZANU-PF crowd was allowed to do as it pleased, a stone throw away from his party's rally. He said while in the past he has told supporters not to retaliate when attacked by ZANU-PF supporters, this time his message is do not fold your hands and watch when being attacked.
But circumstances sometimes dictate behavior. The police are supposed to uphold. They are supposed to uphold peaceful coexistence, peaceful political activity. That's what the Constitution says. Now, in the event that that peace is provoked by individuals, the police cannot be compliant, as far as I am concerned. They cannot be compliant to that kind of action. And if members of the MDC were to take the law into their own hands and also retaliate, then all hell will break loose. We don't want that. All we are saying is that the police must be able to uphold peaceful coexistence amongst different political parties. But if there is a demonstrable bias to support one party against the other, even where there is the legal process followed, then I think that they are sowing seeds for disturbance and chaos.
ZANU-PF members tried to disturb the MDCT rally by holding their own meeting less than 100 meters from the MDCT's venue. And the riot police had to be deployed to avert potential political violence as the two groups chanted against each other. Tsvangirai's stance on retaliating when attacked was backed by MDCT National Youth Leader Yepmo Chidzivagondo, who said no individual has a monopoly to violence in the country. Away from the violence, Tsvangirai said his party will work with anyone who wants to see ZANU-PF removed from office, adding the time is ripe for President Mugabe and his party to go home and rest. He encouraged his supporters to register as voters ahead of the 2018 crucial polls, saying this is the only way they can remove what he said was the yoke put on Zimbabwean's neck by ZANU-PF. Tsvangirai said his party is the only party with the solutions to the country's problems. He chided Mr. Mugabe, saying he can sign as many memorandums of understanding with many countries, but said that will not change his political fortunes on the ground or the country's economic outlook, which continues to look grim. This is Arthur Chigoriwa.
The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission has arrived in the South Sudanese capital, Juba. Festus Mohai, who is also the former president of Botswana, says he plans to meet with President Salva Kiir as well as other stakeholders to the peace agreement. For VOA, Philip Thong-Aleo has more.
As he arrived at Juba International Airport, Mohai had this message for the people of South Sudan.
My greeting is peace unto you, even though I'm not Jesus Christ. Peace, because with peace, everybody is a winner. But at the personal level, I'm absolutely delighted to be here.
Mogai says he will hold talks with President Kiir and members of his administration to learn more about South Sudan from all the stakeholders to the peace agreement.
I'll be doing a lot of listening. After all of you live in this country, are here, and therefore, it's in the logic of circumstance that in my interactions with everybody here is first to listen.
The Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, was established under Chapter 7 of the Peace Agreement and is responsible for overseeing and monitoring aspects of the implementation of the peace deal, which was signed by President Kiir and Machar in August. JMEC will also monitor the permanent ceasefire between the government and the SPLM in opposition. According to the peace agreement, JMEC shall comprise representatives of the parties to the agreement, other South Sudanese stakeholders, and regional and international grantors and partners of South Sudan. Peter Bashir Bandi, the Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, says the government will cooperate with Mogai. Bandi directly addressed Mogai upon his arrival at the airport.
You have been tasked with the responsibility. We trust and we know your country, yes, that you headed was a success story. And I think your choice was not done by accident. Your choice will enrich the peace that we're yearning to have in this South Sudan. I want to assure you that you are most welcome and you will receive each and every cooperation from our people.
Thank you.
And I hope that you will lead this country to real tranquility and peace.
Bandi says Mogai will visit IGAD member countries that helped broker the peace deal. He says Mogai will then return to Juba for the inauguration of the JMEC office on November 18th. For BOA News, I am Philip Thong-Aleo in Juba.
Next on Let's Talk, pet peeves. Do you have one? Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing pet peeves. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent, then we'll have commentary by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. Enjoy.
Yeah. this thing no they end. My baby, na beg, I beg. My baby, you smile. If I pass, I know you lie. My baby, I'm single. My baby, I'm ready
when
to
you're ready up. To burn up the place. We burn up the place. When you're ready to shake up the place. We shake up the place. When you're ready to shut down the place. We shut down the place.
just want to love you, eh. On you I spend my money, eh. Baby, come shake, make you shit, eh. Girl, you got me losing it. That your sexy body sweet. I'll kiss your head down to your feet. Ah, yeah, yeah.
That was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. It's now time for our Saturday commentary and analysis by Dr. Suleiman Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Hello, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. It's always a pleasure for me to share my reflections on U.S. policy towards Africa and to look at African opinions on and attitudes toward the United States. This week, there are many things going on in the world which have implications for African people. The big question really is foreign policy of the U.S. towards Africa and how the United States is dealing with a number of issues. Elections are becoming more and more important for many countries. The elections in Cote d'Ivoire is just part of the other issue about elections and no elections around the continent. Many people are still wondering whether it is possible for many of these African countries to have free and fair elections. We just came out of the elections in Nigeria and the great apprehensions people had about U.S. support for democracy in Nigeria. Fortunately for the Nigerian people and the people of Africa, the election came and the people who supervised the elections managed to resolve the problem successfully. But after all, that was good at the national level, but there are debates in some of the states in Nigeria with regard to their own state elections, just like you have in the United States. America is a big country with many states, and of course you have elections at the gubernatorial level, and they have implications for the nation, but they are particularly relevant to the people of the different localities or states. In Africa, which is much bigger than the United States. But the African political systems are not as organized as it is in the United States. So you don't have elections. In some places, they work out. But in some other places, they still have problems of term limits. The big question of term limits is becoming another big issue. There are many people who are worried about term limits or whether their ruling leaders can be subjected to term limits. So besides the question of elections, the United States government has to develop policies or practical arrangements with regard to elections in different parts of African countries, because the question of recognition of the elections becomes very important. There are many ways in which elections are now becoming important for the U.S. and South Africa. The United States government under President Obama has insisted on many of these African countries that term limits should be important. And this is likely because of U.S. policy about democracy and genuine democracy in these countries, but it's also because of the lobbying efforts of opposition groups in Africa so that they can get U.S. support against their opposition to their own leaders, who sometimes do not want to have elections or they don't want to have free and fair elections. The great debate when you have elections in some of these African countries put the United States on the spot. There are a lot of lobbying before the Nigerian elections. There are people now lobbying with regard to elections that is going to take place in Ghana. There are some of the Ghanaian politicians who are coming to the United States here and trying to see how they can get some kind of coverage or understanding with regard to what is going to happen in Ghana when they have elections, as they plan for it in the coming months and years. The same thing happened in Kenya. The Kenyans came to an election and Uhuru Kenyatta won, but that election has not solved the problem of elections, because the opposition groups are already trying to create the environment for themselves to compete successfully or unsuccessfully against the ruling party in Kenya. The same thing is happening in Rwanda. Some of the opposition groups in Rwanda are bringing the old question of term limits and the eligibility of the leader to run again. Now, in West Africa, you have ECOWAS has been primarily concerned about elections. The great debate about elections has been resolved in Nigeria successfully, and President Buhari's election has solved the problem for the time being. And many Nigerians who are very worried about a number of issues are hoping that Buhari will be able to do something for them. The problem of elections is not elections. The problem is delivery. Can you elect leaders who can deliver the goods and they are sufficiently trained not to be greedy and corrupt? And the problem is not election. The problem is, can you create structures so that you have leaders who are morally worthy of being elected and they are sufficiently committed to the people to rule accordingly? And that's the message one has to leave for Africa, and how American policies can be related to African opinions on and attitude towards democracy.
Thank you, Dr. Nyang. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, John Dryden, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, even if you dance for your enemy on the rock, he will accuse you of splashing water on him. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
North Korea continues to pose a threat to its own people and the international community. In recent congressional testimony, U.S. Special Representative for North Korea Policy Sung Kim said North Korea continues to violate its commitments and international obligations and continues to pursue nuclear weapons and their means of delivery as a strategic national priority, all at the cost of the well-being of its own people and while perpetrating horrific human rights abuses against them. In response, the United States has made clear to North Korea that it stands ready to defend its interests and its allies from the North Korean threat. To that end, the U.S. has strengthened and modernized its military alliances with South Korea and Japan. Even as the U.S. maintains its deterrence capabilities, it continues to apply sanctions pressure on the North Korean regime. In July, the U.S. Treasury Department announced new sanctions and updated its listing for previous North Korean sanctions targets to make it harder for them to hide behind aliases and front companies. Moreover, last year, the U.S. led efforts at the United Nations to sanction North Korea's major global shipping firm. Since then, this designated firm's ships have been denied port entry, scrapped, impounded, or confined to their home ports in North Korea, and the shipping firm has lost its contracts with many foreign-owned ships. Equally important is North Korea's political isolation. This is driven by the consensus that North Korea cannot fully participate in the international community until it abides by its obligations and commitments. The United States and its diplomatic partners, South Korea, Japan, China, and Russia, have all underscored the imperative of denuclearization. Together, said Special Representative Kim, we call on North Korea to refrain from any actions that would raise tensions in the region or threaten international peace and security. Through deterrence, pressure, and diplomacy, the United States and its partners are sending a strong, clear message to North Korea that it must cease threatening its neighbors and respect the human rights of its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.